Nigel Castleman, who's from here.
Daniel got his PhD from Caltech in 1997. He did postdocs at Los Alamos and Microsoft Research, after which he served in the California Berkeley Science Department as a long-term CMI Prize Fellow with the Clay Mathematics Institute. He's best known for work on the stabilizer coformism. And also work on performing quantum gates using quantum teleportation. He was named the MIT Technology Review TR100 Top Young Innovators for 2003, and he's a CIFA Fellow in computer, Quantum Information Processing Program in Canada. Today he's going to talk on spin classes and computational complexity.
Thanks, Lucian. So my field is quantum information processing. And as a field, it's very much an interdisciplinary field, kind of combining computer science and physics, as well as a bunch of other things, you know, math, chemistry, engineering, whatever. But physics and computer science are the main ones in evidence. And this particular topic that I'm talking about today, spin glass and computational complexity, very much brings those two subjects together. So I've decided to present the subject in a slightly more literal sense as a conversation between physics and computer science by personifying the characters. So physics, of course, is here as the stylized atom, and computer science over here as the stylized computer. So let's start with a very basic question, which lets these two sides talk to each other, which is the question of what's a computer? So at one level, this seems like a really obvious thing. This is a computer. But as you start to think about it more from a scientific perspective and try to define really precisely what you mean by a computer, it becomes a much more subtle and difficult question. A computer, obviously, should be something that does computation. But you can think of a lot of different ways of coming up with a device that does computation. And computer scientists, of course, have done this. So, for instance, one of the first really rigorous definitions of what a computer was is the idea of a Turing machine, of course, invented by Turing. And a Turing machine is not a physical device. It's a theoretical device. It has some very long tape, and it has a head which moves around on this tape, and it can write symbols on the tape where it is. The head has some internal states, and the internal states of the head change depending on the symbol on the tape and how it moves, okay? And so this Turing machine you can show will be able to any computer program that you could imagine, any kind of computational process, you can find a Turing machine that will solve it. And in fact, they're universal Turing machines that will follow any program that you can think of. But there's lots of other things you can do. I mean, when we think about a more physical computer, this idea of a Turing machine is too abstract. And usually we come up with something else. For instance, we might have a series of logic gates, AND gates that compute the AND of two bits. You know, if they're both 1, then the AND is 1. And if they're both 0, false, then the output is, or sorry, if either of them is 0, then the output is 0, false. And a NOT gate, you know, that takes true to false, and false to true, 0 to 1, and 1 to 0. And putting together a sequence of such gates, again, you can compute any function that you can think of. And you can do more exotic things. You can imagine a cellular automaton, which, say, in 1D would just be a series of cells. And each cell has a rule to update its value. So it has a couple of possible values. And at the next time step, it'll have a different value that's derived from its value at the last time step, but also the values that its neighbors have, okay? And so this is something where you're doing kind of a whole lot of computation at once, because you have this whole line of cells, and they're all getting updated. But they're only, in this particular example, they're only getting updated locally, depending on what the neighbors are doing. And that, I mean, for physicists, that actually sounds a little more like what happens in a physical system, right, where it's not that there's one place in the universe that's doing something and all the other ones wait around for that to happen. But everywhere in the universe is evolving in some way that depends on what's happening locally. So a cellular automaton is a model of computation, but it's also a kind of discrete model of physics. And in any case, just thinking about these abstract definitions, it's not at all obvious how they're related to each other. Okay? But from the point of view of a computer scientist, they're really all perfectly valid and perfectly good definitions of what a computer is. And the reason for that is that they're all the same. Okay? In particular, any function you can compute on one of them, you can compute on any of the others. And the exact process of how you do that, of course, will be very different. But the same basic properties hold for each of these things. Some functions can be computed. It turns out there are some functions that can't be computed by any program at all. And none of these things can compute those. The other aspect of this is that the time it takes for these things to do the processes, to do the computational processes, are roughly the same. So let's get into that in more detail. I mean, if you think about what I described, for instance, as a cellular automaton in one dimension, you could imagine comparing that to a cellular automaton in two dimensions or three dimensions, right? Or you could have physical gates, like the AND and the NOT gate, that are arranged in a one-dimensional array versus a two-dimensional or three-dimensional array. And surely something that can run in three dimensions is going to work faster than something that runs in one dimension. Simply because, you know, if there's two bits and we want to calculate their AND, in one dimension they might be very far apart. And in order to calculate their AND, we have to bring them close together before we can do anything to them. Whereas in three dimensions, well, they're going to be closer together in general, right? I mean, in principle, you know, if you have N bits, two bits in one dimension can be a distance N apart. But in three dimensions, you can arrange them so that they're both cube root of N apart. Okay, so that's certainly true. And if you look at all these different computational models, you'll find, again, that they don't actually take exactly the same time. Some of them will be faster, some of them will be slower. But they're faster and slower by not very big amounts. And in particular, the differences between them are only polynomial in the size of the thing that you want to compute. Okay? So if you're doing a computation that runs for t time steps on a Turing machine, maybe it'll take t squared time steps on a cellular automaton, but it won't take 2 to the t time steps. Okay? And of course, that's important. Polynomial functions grow much, much slower than exponential functions. And so this means that a problem that can be run, for instance, in polynomial time on one model of computation will also run in polynomial time on another model of computation. So this is a really important idea. So the thing that I mentioned in the last slide, that all these different models of a computer could compute the same thing, that's called the Church-Turing thesis. And this is a strengthening that's been kind of encapsulated in the idea of in the modern theoretical computer science, which is a stronger version, sometimes called the strong Church-Turing thesis, which says that there's lots of different models of a computer, but they're all equivalent up to polynomial factors. Okay, and this is important not just for theoretical computer science, but also for practical computer science. I mean, we're used to the idea that, you know, every few years a new computer will come out, which is, you know, sometimes faster than the previous computer. But what's important is that it runs the same programs as the previous computer did, right? I mean, the operating system might be a little bit different, so maybe those programs have to be translated to run on the new computer. But it's not true that the new computer just, you know, cannot run a program that existed before. And vice versa, the new computer is faster, but any programs that it could run would run on the old computers, just slower, right? And so it might be that it's too slow on the old computer. You don't want to take the time. But the idea is that when the computer gets faster, every program that you run gets faster. Again, there might be some small differences. You know, you might have a processor that does graphics particularly well, so graphics are a little bit faster relative to the other thing. But basically, everything improves at once, okay? And similarly, you know, if you have a Mac or a PC, in principle, they can run the same kinds of programs. Again, it might have to be translated to run from one, from a Mac to run on a PC, or vice versa, more often vice versa, I guess. But in principle, any program that you can write for one of them can also be written to run on the other. Okay? So all of these computers, theoretically speaking, are really the same. And these small differences about well, is it you know, time t or is it time t squared, we're going to sweep those under the rug. And just study the basic properties of which functions can be computed fast and which functions can be computed only after a very long time. And, of course, you can also ask the question of which ones can be computed at all. But I'm not going to get into that in this talk, probably. Okay. So this is something that, as I said, underlies a lot of modern theoretical computer science. The idea that you can talk about an abstract computer and about hard problems, hard programs to run, and easy programs, easy questions. This was really challenged in the mid-90s when Peter Shor showed that there was a factoring algorithm that runs in polynomial time on a quantum computer but takes exponential time on a classical computer. Or I should say, this algorithm can't run at all on a classical computer, but the best algorithms we know for factoring take exponential time. A quantum computer, of course, is a computer where instead of having its memory just be a series of classical bits, its memory is now a quantum state. And instead of doing classical gates on it, it does a series of quantum gates, which are unitary operations. And in particular, those unitary operations can involve change of bases and cause interference between different paths that you might think of as classical computational states. Okay? And that gives the quantum computer more options than the classical computer had. And it turns out, in fact, that a quantum computer has the same class of computable functions as a classical computer. So anything that's computable on a classical computer is also computable on a quantum computer, and vice versa. But as far as we know, there's some problems that can be computed much faster on a quantum computer than they could be on any classical computer. Yeah?
Then you're making an attribute that the same class of functions can be computed on both. Is there more? Are you going to say more about that?
Well, I was not going to say more about it. It's actually very easy to prove. So a quantum computer, as I said, the quantum gates are unitary matrices. Okay? And since this is all kind of computer science thing, I'm going to deal just with finite dimensional Hilbert spaces. So a unitary matrix, so when there's n quantum bits, n qubits in a quantum computer, a unitary matrix is going to be at worst a 2 to the n by 2 to the n matrix. Okay? And so to compute what a quantum computer does, classically, to compute what a quantum computer does, you need to multiply a bunch of 2 to the n by 2 to the n matrices. And you can do that. It just takes a really long time. Okay? So that's why, I mean, it is an interesting thing. It is yet another piece of evidence in favor of the weak version of the Church-Turing thesis. But it's not very hard to prove, at least. And it's not, there doesn't seem to be a lot of interesting stuff to further investigate there. Whereas in terms of what can be done efficiently and not efficiently, that's still a big, interesting open question. Okay. So now we have this nice challenge to the strong Church-Turing thesis of a quantum computer that can do some things much faster than a classical computer. But it maybe shakes our confidence in this whole idea that there's a sensible way to talk about functions which are easy and functions which are hard. Right now, at the minimum, we have to talk about functions which are easy and which are hard on a classical computer or on a quantum computer as separate things. But maybe, you know, even a quantum computer is not the right model. Right? Maybe there's other physical systems that can compute other functions that a quantum computer, efficiently compute other functions that a quantum computer could not. And worse than that, maybe this weak Church-Turing thesis is even wrong, and there are physical systems which can compute some functions which are uncomputable on a classical or quantum computer. Okay? And, I mean, that is really where the interesting question is here that's open, and particularly for you guys doing quantum gravity stuff. I mean, it's not, so as long as we're dealing within the realm of condensed matter and atomic physics and stuff like that, it seems like quantum mechanics is the right physical theory to describe what's going on. And in that situation, a quantum computer, it seems like, really is the ultimate definition. That any kind of fairly reasonable physical system that you can come up with using a condensed matter system or an atomic system or anything with kind of, I want to call it everyday physics, but, you know, everyday for physicists only. is it seems, simulatable on a quantum computer. Again, with some maybe some polynomial slowdown. Okay? So if you had a different way of defining a quantum computer, that people have come up with quantum Turing machines and quantum cellular automata and so on, they all compute the same class of functions up to polynomial factors, polynomial slowdowns. But then when you start to bring in quantum gravity and you're able to bring in new laws of physics, maybe this doesn't hold anymore. So it's possible there's some kind of new quantum gravity computer that can do even more than that. Now that I'm not going to go into. I'm going to focus on just, you know, things we can do with quantum mechanics, regular quantum mechanics, unchained. And nevertheless, there's still a lot of interesting questions to ask. So in particular, let's get back to this this issue of what a quantum computer can do. So on classical computers, people build, you know, very huge simulations to try to figure out properties of quantum systems. And one of the reasons for that is indeed what I just said, which is that a quantum computer can do some things that a classical computer cannot. And computing the properties of a quantum system can take a very long time on a classical computer because, you know, the Hilbert space is 2 to the n dimensional. And you might have to multiply 2 to the n by 2 to the n matrices. Or diagonalize 2 to the n by 2 to the n matrices. And in fact, that's one very common thing that people want to do. They have a Hamiltonian, and they want to find its eigenstates, right? The energy, the values of energy. And in particular, you might say, well, what about the ground state of a Hamiltonian? What's the ground state energy? So that's a very simple, well-defined question. But if you're given an arbitrary Hamiltonian, it doesn't seem like there's a good way to do this on a classical computer. So naturally, you might say, well, let's do this on a quantum computer. That seems like a great subject for a quantum computer to do. And then when you think about it a little more, well, it's not exactly obvious how to do this. The quantum computer, kind of inherently, what it does is a dynamical evolution of a quantum system, right? It has some state, and it evolves it in time. The Hamiltonian is a little bit different, right? If you want to find the ground state energy, that's the stationary state. And naively, you might say, well, I have to know what the ground state is, and then I can see that it stays stationary. But that's not going to work, right? That's putting the answer into the question before you get out the answer. So a better thing to do would be to say, well, let's start the system in some arbitrary state and simulate it interacting with a cold environment, and then it'll cool down to its ground state, okay? And that way we can find the ground state energy. Okay, and that's something that a quantum computer definitely can do, except for the problem is there are systems where if you start them in some arbitrary thermal state, they won't cool down to their ground state in any reasonable amount of time. And so spin glass is a kind of system that has this property. Maybe as long as we're dealing with spins, it's maybe the only kind of system that has the property, because that's more or less how it's defined. And so a spin glass, it doesn't relax to its ground state in a reasonable amount of time. It takes a very, very long time, potentially exponential in the size of the system. And the reason for that is get caught in local energy minima. So how does this work? Well, first, let me back up and say what a spin glass is more carefully. So a spin glass is a kind of spin system. So a spin system, we have a bunch of particles. They each have they're all kind of stationary particles. So they may live on some lattice in 2 dimensions or 3 dimensions or something like that. And they have some internal degree of freedom, okay? So they don't move in physical space, but they do still have some parameter that can depend on the state. And usually this internal degree of freedom is a spin. That's why we call it a spin system. And for the purposes of this talk, I just want to focus on finite dimensional Hilbert spaces of these individual particles. Of course, if you have infinitely many of the particles, the whole Hilbert space will be infinite dimensional. But the individual ones are finite dimensional. So for instance, the simplest case, of course, you have a spin, a half particle. Then each particle has, you know, two basis states, up and down, or of course any superposition of those. And so we can interpret it in terms of quantum computer language as a qubit, right? It has a 0, which is down, and a 1, which is up. Okay, and so what's a spin glass? Well, so spin glasses are a type of spin system that has interactions that, well, make it very hard for it to reach its ground state. So spin glasses were originally proposed as a way to study structural glasses If you've wandered around PI, you've seen a lot of structural glasses. But a spin glass, of course, is just a model of that. Structural glasses, the atoms can move around. In a spin glass, it's only the spins that change. Okay? And spin glasses are designed to have a lot of interactions that kind of contradict each other. So instead of finding a ground state, it'll get caught in some state that has a lot of particles aligned according to these interactions, but not all of them. So for instance, if you take the Ising model in say, three dimensions, and you put in random ferromagnetic or anti-ferromagnetic bonds. So what that means is that two adjacent particles either want to align or they want to be anti-aligned. So this is just a classical spin glass, of course. But eventually, I'll get talking about quantum spin glasses, which same kind of idea. So in this classical spin glass, you can see that if you put random bonds in all possible positions, then it won't be easy to align things, right? If everything were ferromagnetic, then the ground state would just be all the particles are going to be up or all the particles are going to be down, right? But now when you have random bonds, well, maybe these two want to align, but this one wants to anti-align, and then this one here wants to anti-align with this, but maybe it also wants to anti-align with this. And you'll get a contradiction quickly. Right, so for instance, these might want to align, and then these might want to anti-align. And if these want to anti-align also, then these are kind of forced to align. Right? But if this is also an anti-ferromagnetic bond, you have some contradiction. And this is just in a small scale, right? You have to also see the same thing happening on much larger scales. And the catch here is that there may actually be a way to satisfy all of these possible constraints. But it can be very hard to find it. And what will happen is you'll get large regions which everything is kind of locally optimal. But maybe if you changed all of these, every spin in this region, or a lot of a large number of spins in this region, you'd find one that was globally even better. Okay, and that's what makes this type of thing a spin glass, because it has local energy minima, where there's no small change you can make that will make it better. But these are different from the global energy minima, and may be very different with lots of different spins changed. Which is kind of the best way to frustrate as few possible interactions. Okay? Okay. So here we have a system where it's the kind of the natural simulation of dynamics will not get us to the ground state. And that's because it gets caught in these local energy minima. So in other words, this is a system where if somebody gave you the ground state, you could very quickly see that it has lower energy than anything you were able to come up with on your own. But if you're not given that extra information, you're really at a loss for what to do. You can find local energy minima easily, but finding a global one, that seems very hard. And it turns out that there's actually lots of computational problems that have similar properties. Problems where if somebody gives you a hint and tells you what the answer is, you can check and see that they're correct. But if without that hint, you really have no idea what to do. Okay? And you can try some stuff, but it won't give you the optimal solution.
If somebody gave you the wrong answer and it was just another local minimum, would you really be able to tell
so,
that was
okay.
the wrong answer?
So in order to answer that, let me actually, it's maybe easier to talk about some of these other examples, and then I'll get back to that. So let's take graph coloring. That's actually a pretty easy example to get this point down. So in graph coloring, we have some graph. It doesn't have to be in 2D or 3D. It's just, 3D is an arbitrary graph. So you have a graph, right? So you have points that are connected by edges. And what you'd like to know is there a way of coloring the nodes of this graph so that no two adjacent nodes have the same color. Okay? Now, obviously, this is going to depend on the graph and how many colors you have available. So, for instance, let's suppose you have three colors available. The question now becomes, can you three-color this graph? Some graphs you can three-color, some graphs you can't. And it turns out that this is a very hard problem to solve. Okay? But if somebody gives you a three-coloring of the graph, it's very easy to look through and see that it is, in fact, a three-coloring. But without that hint, you don't know what to do, right? You can color one node and then another node and another node, but it may be that you'll, after some time, you'll run into a contradiction, and then you have to back up and make a different decision earlier on. And there's an exponential branching process that takes place in your decision tree, okay? And so that's why it's going to take a very long time. Again, you can find kind of local minima where you're coloring large numbers of nodes correctly. But globally, maybe that causes a problem. And to get the global coloring, then you have to back up and try something very different. Okay, so for the Hamiltonian question, say of a spin system or spin glass, you have to define the question as a decision problem. So is the energy, is the ground state energy below E or above E plus 1? Let's say the energies are integers. Okay? And in that case, if somebody gives you a local minimum that has energy E plus 1, well, you can verify that its energy actually is E plus 1 and it's no good. And if the ground state energy is E, and if somebody gives you this ground state, then you can see that, in fact, there's a ground state energy E. Well, yes and no. So suppose you had some procedure that let you answer just as a black box, does this system have ground state energy below E or above or not? Okay. Then what you could do is you could change E and narrow down the actual energy. So this is really kind of, computationally speaking, this is equivalent to the more abstract question of what is the ground state energy. But there is an important thing here, which is, so I didn't say this yet, but this class of problems is called NP, problems where you can check the answer easily, but it's hard to find it if nobody gives you the hint. I mean, potentially hard to find. NP doesn't require that. Which is that it's not symmetric, okay? That there's a yes answer and a no answer. So the yes answer, for instance, for graph coloring, is yes, the graph is three-colorable. The no answer is no, the graph is not three-colorable. In that case, there's no obvious evidence that somebody could give you that would convince you of that. Right? I mean, to figure it out yourself, you have to try all graph coloring, but that's exponential time. Okay? So the same issue, of course, arises with the spin glasses. If the ground state energy is low, there's a way of proving that by presenting the ground state. But if the ground state energy is high, well, it's very difficult to prove that there isn't some other state out there that has lower energy. Okay, so that's kind of inherent in this definition of NP. Okay, and then NP complete problems are the hardest problems in NP. And it turns out you can prove using the methods of theoretical computer science that that some of these problems, and these are three examples, are indeed the hardest problems in NP. If you could solve one of these problems in general, not a specific instance, but you know, you could solve all graph three-coloring problems, then you could solve any problem in NP in polynomial time. And so it turns out that finding the ground state energy of a spin system is, in fact, one of these NP complete problems. And the way you can show this is by showing that if you could solve this spin system problem, you could solve some other NP complete problem. In particular, you could solve satisfiability of Boolean formulas. So satisfiability of Boolean formulas, you have some Boolean equation, say, x1 or x2 or not x3 and x3 and not x2, et cetera. And so it's just something that takes true-false values on a bunch of variables and calculates some logical function of those. You can convert that into a Hamiltonian such that the Hamiltonian is going to be, you can completely satisfy all terms in the Hamiltonian if and only if this Boolean formula has an assignment of truth values that satisfies it, okay? And the way you do that is you just take each clause in the Boolean formula and convert it into a term in the Hamiltonian, right? And each variable will become a spin. So a variable that's true will be spin up, and a variable that's false will be spin down. And then if you have a clause like x1 or x2 or x3, so that's satisfied if any of these three things is true, then you can write a little Hamiltonian term that gives you energy 1 if none of them is true, and gives you energy 0 if any of them is true. Okay? And so that Hamiltonian will only involve three particles, in fact. And it turns out that three satisfiability, where each clause has three variables, is already an NP-complete problem. And so a spin system involving three particles at a time in the Hamiltonian will be NP-complete. Okay? And again, the reason it works is that if there's something that satisfies every single clause, then you can use that to find a truth assignment that satisfies the Boolean formula. And if not, then you have a situation where you have a lot of local minima, but the global minimum is not zero. Its global minimum is still only energy 1. Okay? And, well, I won't explain this picture. It's not really all that helpful. Okay. So, okay. I guess this is mostly what I said. But the point is, how does this show it's NP complete? Well, suppose you had a machine that solves a spin system problem. Okay, classical computer, quantum gravity computer, whatever. So somehow it solves a spin system problem. You could use this to solve arbitrary NP problems. And the way you do that is you'd first convert the arbitrary problem into a satisfiability problem. There's a way to do that. And then once you have an arbitrary satisfiability problem, you convert it into the appropriate Hamiltonian. And then you put this Hamiltonian into the machine. And the machine will tell you whether this Hamiltonian has ground state energy 0 or not. Okay? And if it has ground state energy 0, then you know that the Boolean satisfiability problem was satisfiable. And if it doesn't have ground state energy 0, then you know it didn't. So solving the spin system problem then gives you the answer to this satisfiability problem. Okay? Okay. Right. So, but this argument also works the other way. Okay? Once you know that answering the question of the spin system question is difficult, you know that there exists spin glasses with the same kind of property. Why is that? Well, we could use the algorithm that I discussed before. Suppose you were to build this spin system and try to cool it down. Right? Well, that's something you could simulate if it's a classical spin system, you could simulate it on a classical computer. If it's a quantum spin system, you could simulate it on a quantum computer. Okay? And then this computer simulation would find the ground state energy if the system cools down to its ground state. Okay? So that would give you an algorithm. The simulation of the cooling process would be an algorithm that would actually answer this spin system question. Okay? But we know that algorithm doesn't exist. So what's the weak link in this argument? The weak link is that cooling is going to have to take an exponential amount of time. Okay? So understanding this computational process can actually tell us something about the physics of these Hamiltonian systems. Okay? And so that's where the rest of the talk is going to focus on. I'm going to try to study the computational complexity of various kinds of spin systems. And you should understand that as meaning that tells us something about whether these systems can be spin glasses or not. Yeah. Yes. Yes, it did. It also relied kind of on some quantum version of this strong Church-Turing thesis, in the sense that maybe there's some kind of environment that can't be simulated on a quantum computer, and then the algorithm that I propose also failed. So we need to know that that actually these problems are computationally hard, and we need to know that you know that any reasonable physical system can be simulated on an appropriate kind of computer. So those are the really two assumptions behind it. Now it's also true that you can have a spin glass that's not a computationally hard system. Okay, and there's two other issues here. So you can have a spin glass that's not a computationally hard system simply because there might be some really weird algorithm that can find the ground state, but you know natural cooling process doesn't do that. Okay, so that's one thing. On the other side, it's hard to actually say that a specific instance of a problem is a hard instance. Okay, this is not something we really can do in theoretical computer science. So it can be, for some of these problems, it can be that the cases that are actually the hard cases, like, so for instance, graph coloring, a lot of the time it's very easy to tell whether there's a three coloring or not, right? I mean, if you have a tetrahedron in the graph somewhere, then there can't be a three coloring, right? Because so here you have four nodes that are all connected to each other, and no two of them can have the same color. So obviously you can't three-color this graph. So a lot of times graph coloring is actually an easy question. And so it can be that you can say, well, this general class of systems is hard, and therefore there must be spin glasses somewhere there. But maybe most of the specific examples you'll come up with are not hard. So that's another, it's not really an assumption in the argument, but it's kind of a caveat. Okay? Okay. So then let's move on. So I talked about NP and kind of about P. So P is the class of problems you can do in polynomial time on a classical computer. NP is the class of problems you can check in polynomial time on a classical computer, but you might not be able to find the answer on your own. And then we need quantum versions of these. So we have BQP, which is things you can do in polynomial time on a quantum computer. And QMA is going to be the quantum analog of NP, things you can check in polynomial time on a quantum computer. Okay? And this Venn diagram represents what we think is the correct relationship between these classes. So P, of course, is inside all of these. If you can solve it on a classical computer, you can certainly solve it on a quantum computer, because a quantum computer can do anything classical. And if you can check it on a classical computer, you can certainly, if you can solve it on a classical computer, you can certainly check it on a classical computer just by solving it yourself. Okay. But we think there are problems in NP that are not in P. We think there are problems in BQP that are not in P. We think there are problems in BQP that are not in NP, and vice versa. But there also seem to be some problems that are in both that are not in P. Like factoring large numbers is in NP, because if somebody gives you the factors, you can multiply them together to check, and we can solve it on a quantum computer. But we don't know any good algorithm, classical algorithm, to factor numbers. And then QMA, we think, it has to contain all of these things, because it kind of subsumes both the checking and the quantum aspects. But we think it probably contains some problems that are not in any of these other classes. The thing is that in classical computer science, we have a lot of guesses about how these classes are related. But when it comes to proving that two classes are different, you can almost never do that. And so we don't actually know for sure that these classes are different. This is just the best guess. Okay. So QMA is kind of a funny name. And the name comes from quantum Merlin Arthur. So there's a little story that goes with it. So, of course, this is a quantum analog of a classical complexity class called Merlin Arthur, which is the probabilistic version of NP. And the story goes like this. You have two people. You have Arthur and Merlin. Merlin is a wizard. He's very powerful. He can do any computation. Arthur is merely mortal. He's a king, so he's pretty powerful for a mortal. But nevertheless, he has computational limits. In this case, he's actually maybe slightly more than mortal since he has a quantum computer, but that's a simplification. Okay, so Merlin is Arthur's advisor. Unfortunately, Arthur doesn't really trust Merlin. You know, wizards can't necessarily believe everything they say. So Arthur insists that whenever Merlin makes a pronouncement about the answer to a computational problem, he'd be able to prove it. Okay? So you can see that this kind of encapsulates the idea of NP, or in this case, QMA. That Merlin can solve computational problems, but he can only do so in such a way where he can present some proof to Arthur that Arthur can check, in this case, using his quantum computer. And in the case of QMA, the proof itself could be a quantum state that Arthur can put into his quantum computer and run a quantum computation. And somehow this has to convince him that the answer is valid. So what's an example of a QMA problem? Well, based on the previous discussion, you might infer correctly that quantum Hamiltonians provide a good example of QMA problems. Okay? So now we're not going to just deal with classical spin systems, but also quantum spin systems. And in particular, I want to deal with something called a K-local Hamiltonian. So a K-local Hamiltonian is a Hamiltonian which is a sum of terms, each of which acts on, at most, K spins. Okay? Of course, there may be many more than K spins in the whole system, but the terms are restricted in how many particles they interact with. And despite the word local, these particles have no geometry associated with them. They can be anywhere. Okay? So you can have something, a three local Hamiltonian, connect a particle here with one that's here, with one that's, you know, all the way up there. That's fine. And this three local Hamiltonian, or K local in general, is in QMA. So why is that? Well, in order to, so the question, is the ground state energy below E, or is it above E plus delta? So this is a yes or no question. QMA should be decision problems with yes and no answers. And I had this difference between E and E plus delta just to say that we don't necessarily want to answer it with 100, with, you know, perfect precision. There's some accuracy delta, and that's good enough. And so why is this problem in QMA? Well, Merlin, if he says the energy is below E, the ground state energy is below E, he can prove that to Arthur by providing a copy of the ground state. And then using his quantum computer, Arthur can measure the energy of this ground state and see that it is, in fact, below E. But you can see we need this delta, right? Because Arthur is not going to be able to measure the ground state with perfect energy precision. There's going to be some accuracy. And so that's why we need this delta, which, you know, he can work harder and measure it to higher accuracy, but that's still just going to be kind of polynomial in the number of spins. Okay. So this problem is in QMA. It turns out that it's actually one of these hard problems. It's QMA complete. Okay, so how would one show that? Well, so Kataev originally showed this for five local Hamiltonians. And the way he did this is, in general, to prove that a problem is complete, you have to take some arbitrary problem from QMA and convert it into an instance of a Hamiltonian problem. So you want to take, somebody gives you this arbitrary QMA problem X, and you want to find the Hamiltonian whose ground state energy is low if and only if the answer to X is yes. So the way he did this was he said, well, the only thing we know about X is that it has a witness, some evidence that the answer is yes, that can be checked easily on a quantum computer. And so let's write down the circuit that does this checking process. Okay? And then we're going to do a Hamiltonian which kind of simulates, whose ground state simulates the evolution of the circuit. In the following sense, the Hamiltonian is of the form sum over t, phi sub t, tensor t. So t represents the time in the circuit. Phi sub 0 is the original state, the input state. Phi sub 1 is time 1. Phi sub 2 is time 2, and so on. But here, that time is just encapsulated as an extra register, right? So what we're doing is we're kind of simulating the time using the superposition of the quantum state, okay? And it turns out you can write down the Hamiltonian whose ground states will have to be of this form, and because at the end you have a yes or no thing, you can add an extra term that says, well, the ground state of this form will have low energy only if the input state passes this circuit and gives a yes output, okay? And if not, if anything you put in here has a no output, then anything of this form has a higher energy. Okay, and anything not of this form will also have a higher energy. Okay, so that means that this Hamiltonian has a low ground state energy if and only if there is some possible solution that's valid, that passes this check for the question X. Okay? So anyway, so that's five local Hamiltonian is QMA complete. So that means it's a very hard question. We think that it means it can't even be checked on a classical computer. Okay, so why is this an interesting question? Well, maybe I gave you some hint already that by studying the computational complexity, we learned something about the physics. But I think it's worth mentioning a few other things. So for instance, I originally motivated this particular class of problems by saying this is something we'd like to solve on a computer, right? We'd like to have an algorithm that computes the ground state energy of systems. But you know, we know that this problem is hard, so we know that there is no algorithm that's going to compute it for general systems. We do have algorithms that work very well for smaller classes of spin systems, and this, by studying which problems are hard and which problems are not hard, you can kind of set limits on how far you can extend such algorithms. Okay? So this kind of guides you for looking for algorithms to actually answer this question, classical or quantum. Another thing is spin glasses are not really very well understood physically. This is something that people still work on very heavily. And maybe thinking about this computational viewpoint can give you some new insights into that. The other thing is that this Hamiltonian problem was the first problem that was proved QMA complete. And then using that, you can then prove that other computational problems are QMA complete. And then finally, the techniques that have been developed for this type of study are useful for other types of things that you want to do with spins, like building an adiabatic spin quantum computer. Okay, so what we'd really like to do is say, here's a Hamiltonian. Is it a hard Hamiltonian or an easy Hamiltonian? And maybe you might want to change that a little more and say, is it a spin glass or not a spin glass? But from a computer science point of view, that's not really the right question, right? Because hard problems have to be a class of problems. Any given problem has an answer, yes or no, okay? But a class of problems has a difficulty because you can say, as the problems in this class get bigger and bigger, how does the difficulty scale with the size, okay? And that's what distinguishes the hard problems and the easy problems. The hard problems are a class where the difficulty scales only polynomially with the size. Sorry, the easy problems scale only polynomially with the size. And the hard problems scale exponentially with the size. Okay, so what are the hard classes of Hamiltonians? So let's look at classical spin systems first. So in classical spin system, we know that free satisfiability is hard, is NP complete, and so that means that free local Hamiltonian is NP complete. On the other hand, it turns out that if you're using bits, the two satisfiability, in other words, two local Hamiltonian, classical spin system, is easy. There's a polynomial time algorithm to do that. So let's try to narrow the gap between this. So this three satisfiability thing is if you want to satisfy everything in the clause. Two satisfiability is you want to satisfy, again, every clause. But if you just want to satisfy as many clauses as possible, then it turns out that two local Hamiltonian problem is hard. It's something called max two set. It's the analogous classical problem. So nevertheless, these are still kind of unsatisfactory from a physical point of view because they involve interactions between very far away particles. So let's restrict some more to two dimensions. Okay, so we have a spin system in two dimensions, and we have local terms in two dimensions. So nearest neighbor particles interact. This could also be viewed as a tiling problem. Instead of spins, you have a bunch of different colors and of tiles, and different tiles can go next to each other depending on the pair of colors. So anyway, this problem is also hard. But if you go to one dimension, then this problem is easy, even when you just say we want to satisfy as many things as possible. But again, this is still kind of unsatisfactory from a physics point of view. The problem is that the systems that you use here are kind of weird. I gave you the example of the Ising model with random spins, so that's not so bad. But random spins, we don't really know how to prove anything from a computational complexity point of view. To actually prove this, what you need is interactions that vary from place to place, but in some kind of carefully determined manner that makes it simulate some computation. That's very weird from a physics point of view. We'd like something simpler, For instance, we'd like to say, what about translational invariant system? Okay, so it turns out there, the problem is still hard, in two dimensions at least. But you have to use a different complexity class called Next, which I'll define in a moment. And of course, if you do it in 1D, it's easy. But what's worth noting is that not only is it easy, but it's much easier. Okay, so if you have two local Hamiltonian without translational invariance, it takes polynomial time as a function of the number of spins. But if you have translationally invariant one-dimensional Hamiltonian, it takes polynomial time in the log of the number of spins. Okay, so that in this case, translational invariance makes it easy. In this case, it doesn't makes it from easy to easier. In this case, it stays hard. Okay, so next, what is that? Well, it's like NP, except that we now allow an exponentially long checking circuit. Okay, so this is actually a much harder class than NP, which is weird. You wouldn't think that translationally invariant would make it harder. And in fact, of course, it doesn't. And the reason is kind of a technical one. The reason we have to go to next here is that the input now is the number of spins presented in binary. So the input is only log n in size. So really what this is saying is that it's next complete as a function of log n. So the time it should take would be exponential in the size of the checking circuit, which is exponential in log n. Okay, so that's exponential of log n, which is exponential of n. Okay, whereas the NP complete problems also take just exponential of n. So really, these are kind of comparable results. It's just a technicality that forces them to be different. Okay, so since I'm running out of time, let's go to the quantum spin systems. So in quantum spin systems, we have Kitaya's result that says that five local Hamiltonians are QMA complete. But on the other hand, there's a lot of, say, one-dimensional systems that can be solved using DMRG or something else. And therefore, we know that some 1D systems are easy. And actually, a lot of 1D systems turn out to be easy. So there's now a lot of room in between, and subsequent research has filled in a lot of this. So it turns out that five local is not necessary. You can have two local Hamiltonians. So again, this is no geometry. These particles can be anywhere, but you have only two body terms. So that's good. That's a lot more physically realistic than five body terms. Let's put in some geometry. So we have nearest neighbor interactions in 2D. Turns out that's still hard, QMA complete. That's not surprising, right? After all, the classical problem was NP complete, so the quantum problem makes sense would be QMA complete. But it turns out even if you go to 1D, the quantum problem is still QMA complete. And the reason here is that with superposition, you have really a lot more freedom. I don't want to get into the details of that, of course, but this is a case where the quantum problem in 1D is really harder than the classical problem. Now, this, in order to make this work, we can't do it with spin or half particles. We have to use bigger system. And so we don't really know what the complexity is if you have qubits. Okay, so now let's go to translational invariance. Well, it turns out that even with translational invariant, in 1D, the problem is still hard, right? So you have 1D quantum spin systems with translational invariant interactions that are QMA, not QMA complete, it's now, again, QMA X complete, kind of the same thing, NP to next is QMA to QMA X. Which means, for instance, that there's 1D quantum spin systems, which should be spin glasses. Turns out even if you add more symmetry and make this reflection invariant, so interactions to the left and right are the same, it's still QMA X complete, still hard. Yeah?
Mentions the particles in those last two examples?
Well, some constant number, which is unfortunately very large, but doesn't change with the number of particles in the system. So in this case, my estimate was maybe about 1,000 dimensional spins. Okay. In this case, it's even bigger, but I didn't even do a back of the envelope calculation. Now, this is not, I mean, we didn't make much attempt to optimize that. So this is just, but it's more of a proof in principle. So like I said, QMAX is the analog of next. It's the problem where you can check it on a quantum computer, but it takes exponential time. Sorry, you can check it on a quantum computer in exponential time. but it might take even longer than that to find the answer. And again, there's this business where the input is only log n, so it's kind of morally the same as QMake will be. So there's one interesting thing about these translational invariant Hamiltonians, both classically and quantumly, which is that, remember I said that you had to look at a class of Hamiltonians. But in the translational invariant Hamiltonians, you can just fix the Hamiltonian term, and the class is just the number of particles. Okay? So you're studying the complexity as you make the system larger, but you can just fix the interaction and say, is this a hard interaction or an easy interaction? And that, I think, is something pretty interesting, because that's something we couldn't do before. It's a well-defined question about a specific Hamiltonian term. What is its computational complexity? Okay, so that brings me to the end. So we have now, it turns out that for quantum systems at least, you can add lots and lots of symmetry. You can go to 1D, and it still gives you a computationally hard class of problem. Obviously, there are some Hamiltonian terms which are going to be easy, and a lot of them will be. But there also, apparently, are Hamiltonian terms that are hard. And so one big open question, I think, is to answer which ones are easy and which ones are hard. You don't have tools to do that. And in particular, what I'd really like to do, I mean, for this result, we had to come up with some very strange Hamiltonian term that, you know, let us prove something. But what I'd really like to do is take some Hamiltonian that somebody's interested about for some other reason and understand that it was hard. Obviously, there are specific cases where somebody's interested in Hamiltonian. We know it's easy because, like, it's solvable or something. But so far, I think the examples where it's computationally hard are either very artificial or very circumstantial. Okay, so again, let me just bring back to this point of saying something about the physics of these systems. So these translationally invariant Hamiltonians that are spin glasses are very different in some sense from the usual spin glasses that people think about. Normally, when people think about spin glasses, they use random interactions, like the example of the random Ising model. And in fact, you'll see in the literature claims that spin glasses are actually different from structural glasses, because structural glasses, underlying it, all the atoms have the same interactions. Whereas in a spin glass, you have this quenched randomness of having random interactions between the different particles. Okay? But this translationally invariant Hamiltonian, the hard translationally invariant Hamiltonian, don't have that property. They have the same interactions between particles. And any randomness you might see is just because the system can't find its ground state. It ends up in some local minimum, and that's kind of random depending on where it started and how it cooled. But this is kind of an emergent disorder of the system rather than one that you put in at the start. Okay. And then I mentioned there's various open questions. I mentioned particularly this question of which Hamiltonians are hard, which ones are easy. But there's other questions of interest to computer scientists and interest to physicists. So for instance, this precision that we need in measuring the energy, depending on how you set that precision, the problem might change from being easy to being hard, right? So finding the ground state energy with a high precision, in the examples that I've used, 1 over polynomial number of particles, that's hard. But maybe finding it to a constant precision is easy. So that's something we don't have an understanding for. And then you can look at other properties of a Hamiltonian and say, what about Hamiltonians that have a spectral gap? The classical spin systems always have a spectral gap because their energies are integers. But the quantum spin systems in the large n limit become gapless. So what about systems with a spectral gap? Are there QMA complete problems there? I don't know. And there's lots more, I think, interesting questions to look at that I haven't put here. But I'm out of time, so I'll stop.
Take questions first from students. If you solved a spin glass and found its ground state energy, if you add an extra spin, could it in theory completely change the ground state energy?
Yeah, so these translationally invariant spin glasses, that's kind of why they're hard. So This gets back to the precision issue, actually. So the energy doesn't totally change. It changes by basically this amount delta. That's the precision, okay? But it changes very unpredictably. So you add one spin, maybe the energy goes up by delta. You add another one, it doesn't change. Another one, it doesn't change. And then another one, it goes down again. So this is not a hard example, but you can think of this as, suppose you have an anti-ferromagnetic interaction, so spins want to anti-align, and you look at even versus odd, let's say with periodic boundary conditions, okay? So in that case, if they want to align, even is okay, because, you know, half the particles will be up, half the particles will be down, and when you get back, it'll be right, and odd is not. So even has a ground state energy of 0, odd has a ground state energy of 1. So this is kind of like that, except the even-odd case, it's very easy to say, oh, is it even or odd? In this general case, it's very difficult to say when it goes up and when it goes down without trying all sorts of different possibilities. That takes too long.
Does he have any chief to know the precision for the energy?
Sorry?
Does he have any chief for the precision that you require?
So the all the cases are hard. So the in the classical cases, the classical spin system, the precision is just 1, because you can set all the energies to be integers and it works just as well. In the quantum case, the precision for the hard cases is, I think, always 1 over a polynomial in the number of particles. And exactly what that polynomial is depends on some of the details of the proof. But beyond that, we don't really know. I'm sorry, I'm not sure if that was exactly your question. Okay.
Okay, let's open up the questions generally.
Does having multiple ground states affect things to sort of just make it easier?
That's not clear. So there's kind of a heuristic picture, for instance, in satisfiability. Satisfiability, you have, say, a fixed number of variables, and suppose you add more and more clauses constraining what these variables can be. So if you have very few clauses constraining the variables, then it's almost always going to be satisfiable, right? Because unless you happen to have two contradictory clauses, it's going to work. But as you add more and more clauses, there are going to be fewer and fewer possible satisfying assignments. So in other words, the ground state of the set of ground states of the corresponding Hamiltonian gets smaller and smaller. And then it seems that at the point where you're likely to have only one solution, that's where it really gets hard. And then on the other side, as you have more and more contradictory things, well, then it's almost always going to be unsatisfiable, and it gets easier. So it may be that something similar happens in kind of the more general Hamiltonian case, that the hardest cases are concentrated on having just one ground state. But at a minimum, you kind of have to take the symmetry into account, right? So in these translational invariant Hamiltonians, well, if you have a periodic system, the whole thing is translational invariant. So if you have one ground state and you shift it by one spin, it still has to be a ground state. So they will always have a degenerate subspace because let me take back the always. They will almost always. It may be that it's possible to come up with some system that only has a translationally invariant ground state, but the ones in the examples that we've come up with don't. So it seems like maybe having fewer ground states should make it harder, but it doesn't seem like an absolute rule. Yeah.
Are there interesting problems connected with symmetries of ground states, particularly, for example, in translational invariant systems?
Yeah, I think so. It's not something that's really been explored. I would class that kind of here, which is that you say we're putting some... So translational invariance is kind of an obvious property of the Hamiltonian. You can look at the Hamiltonian and immediately tell whether it has this property. Spectral gap is not an obvious property of the Hamiltonian, right? If somebody gives you the Hamiltonian, it's actually quite hard to tell whether it has how big a spectral gap it has. And so properties of ground state hold the same class, and actually telling whether it has this property or not is very difficult. But nevertheless, it's an interesting question to ask. You know, is this Hamiltonian going to have a translation invariant ground state or not? Well, I mean, if the Hamiltonian translation invariant has to, but if it's quantum. But anyway, there's, yes, so before I get myself too confused, let me just say yes, there are interesting questions there.
Yeah, I think you gave us examples of the self-induced kind of
right
emergent classy behavior or something. Are all the ones you gave us quantum? And if so, are there examples of that even with classical?
Yeah, there are. So, I mean, I went through relatively quickly, but so if you look at this two-dimensional translational invariant tiling problem, it's hard, okay? So the analogous classical system should be glassy, and that's a classical case where you have to have kind of self-induced disorder.
So is it kind of because the frustration is built in locally, and then you just reproduce frustrated things over and over, or is there something more subtle going on?
Well, it's a little more subtle than that. So the thing is that what's actually the case is that the true ground state of these systems, these translational invariant tiling, the true ground state actually has energy zero. I mean, for the yes instances, it has energy zero. So there is some global way of satisfying all the interactions. But the problem is it's very hard to find, because locally it's relatively easy to satisfy all the constraints. But as you start to grow this, you'll eventually run into a contradiction. Okay? But the problem is actually the opposite, which is not that it's hard to satisfy all the constraints, but that there's too many ways to satisfy the constraints locally. But there's not so many that you won't eventually run into contradictions if you just pick one at random.
Huh. And would you say that in the quantum case it was just one dimensional, so it's very hard to understand.
Right.
It's hard in that
picture. It's hard to imagine what's going on in the quantum case. But basically, the answer is the additional degree of freedom that superposition and entanglement gives you makes this possible. That again, you can kind of locally get something that'll work, but it'll have terms in the superposition that will eventually cause you trouble when they start to interfere down the road, or they run into a Hamiltonian term that forbids one of them, something like that.
Can you imagine a toy physical theory which gives you more computational power than quantum computers? Or?
It depends what you mean by imagine. it's easy to write down such theories. They tend to have very strange physical properties. So an example, for instance, would be if you have quantum mechanics, but you can also post-select on the outcomes of measurements. So you do a measurement, and instead of just getting a random result, you can say, I want this result. So this has more computational power than a quantum computer, again, with the usual caveats about you can't prove separation of complexity classes. But it also allows fashion-like communication and backwards in time communication and is pretty weird. If you want to have a toy theory that is kind of, some sense, physically reasonable, I don't know of a good example that has more computational powers.
So is it clear that which physical principles you have to abandon to, I mean,
no.
Get to?
No, it's not clear at all.
Do polymers have the power to provide experimentally interesting results on your system? On your translationally invariant systems?
So you want to do just a single strand of polymer? As your 1D system?
Yes. Well, you want me to make it fancy, you do DNA, but you
right.
Must not make it fancy.
I'm not sure. I mean, so like I said, the hard problems that we've come up with are kind of artificial ones that have been cooked up. It may be you could engineer a polymer that actually has the right properties. normally when I think about doing this experimentally, I would think about it in a kind of more explicit quantum computing sense of building structured superconductors or something that has these interactions. But yeah, maybe you could do it in polymers too.
So NX is harder than NP, right?
Right.
In some sense.
So
right. I find it kind of surprising that in some cases adding translational invariance makes things
harder,
and sometimes it makes
so it doesn't. It doesn't actually make it harder. That's what this slide was supposed to talk about. So NXP is harder than NP, but the problem is that
the input
is different.
Shorter.
Okay,
so
the input becomes shorter, and the extra checking time totally cancels the smaller input. Okay, so the expectation is that an NP complete problem takes time exponential in number of particles, and that the next complete translational invariant problems also take time that's exponential in the number of particles. So they could be kind of roughly the same complexity. So the question is not whether it makes it harder or makes it easier. The question is whether it makes it about the same or it makes it easier.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you have any thoughts on the fact that for every frustrated network, there's an associated Bell inequality.
No. We can talk about it later.
Any more questions? Well, if not, let's thank Daniel.